Hello and welcome to the SBRPF. My name is Luke Burge and this is the show where I review every science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. So it's a little bit, it's been quite a while since the last podcast, mainly because I had a book that I wanted to review and do an episode with Juliana, but she had a really bad throat a few weeks ago. And then I thought, well, we'll just wait until I go off to this festival, this juggling festival that I was working at, And so we'll do that, and then I'll come back, and we'll do the episode. But when I came back, I was totally tired, and I destroyed my voice. And so I had a really bad throat and a really bad cough. And a week and a half later, my throat is still pretty bad, but I'm going to see if I can finally get through an episode by myself without coughing too much. If I cough, I will turn away from the microphone a bit. Not that I have a microphone, I'm just recording this straight into my phone, see how that works. And so hopefully I can get through this okay. So today's book that I'm going to be reviewing is called Permutation City by Greg Egan, and it's a 13-hour audiobook, and I found it there, and I was like, yes, I will check this out. I could remember it had been recommended by a few listeners to the podcast, and I thought, well, I quite like mind-bending hard science fiction, so I'll give it a go. And I'd read a Greg Egan book before, way back on episode number 70 of the SRFBP, a book called Shield's Ladder, And I quite enjoyed that one, mind-bending, like I said, mind-bending hard science fiction, so I thought I'd give this one a go. And I started reading it, and because a few people had recommended it recently, I presumed that it was a new novel, but I started reading it, and it felt a little bit familiar. There was more than a little bit familiar, but it started off in this guy who wakes up, and he's inside of a simulation, and he's like, oh, I'm inside a simulation, right, okay, computer simulation, my brain is being simulated, and he kind of talks through about how the different levels of simulation, so right in the brain, all the synapses are, and the molecules of the brain are simulated exactly. And then as you go out to the skull, okay, the brain is all the synapses are there, but just outside the brain. As soon as you get outside the brain, less is simulated. Or it's all simulated, but not down to the cellular or molecular level. It's just sort of like, okay, we've just got some more broader systems than the rest of the body, like non-vital organs. Okay, that's that needs even like a cruder simulation. And the room that you're in, even cruder simulation. And then what do you see? And you look into the background, you're like, oh, okay, outside is even more like crude simulation. And so he wakes up and he goes and he goes exploring in the room and immediately tries to kill himself because that's what all simulations apparently do. And so then he goes outside when him killing himself doesn't work, and he explores in the city. And this for me was like, oh, I've definitely read this before. I didn't remember that it being a whole novel. I've read it before. Okay, well, maybe it's not a whole novel. Maybe it's a short story, and I read the short story version, which made up the first chapter of this book. That's what often happens with these novels, like a fix-up novel, or there'll be a novella version or a novel, like a short story version that gets expanded out into a novel. I was thinking, well, maybe that's why I don't recognize all of it. But I kept on reading. Oh no, this is definitely it, because there's this line that they said, oh, when things are being simulated, you can't simulate human consciousness at full speed. You have to slow it down 17 times. And I was like, ah, the figure of having to be slowed down 17 times, it makes me sure, totally sure, that I've definitely read this before. But I was like, I can't remember anything much about it. Anyway, so I carried on, and I was enjoying it a lot. But then we got into the third chapter, and some other stuff was happening. I was like, yes, I have definitely read this before. And the next chapter, something else happened. I was like, yes, I have definitely read this before as well. So as I was going through, more and more scenes were coming back to me, going, oh, this is a really memorable scene. And I remember reading it before, but I didn't remember it was in this book. Oh, and here's a very interesting thought experiment that I've thought about many times since I read this first time. So it turns out this book came out in 1995, and I read it before, but I'd forgotten that it was this book. And this is one of the main reasons that I started the SPFRB, was to avoid this same thing happening, because I think I've talked about it before on the podcast, that I started an Alistair Reynolds book, and like for the third time was like, oh, I'd forgotten that I'd read this, and the last time I forgot that I read this, I forgot that as well. So I was like doing it for like the third or fourth time, trying to start a book, and thinking, well, I know I've read some books by this author, but have I read this book? And so now I can easily look back through the SFBRP. Of course, you do have Goodreads and stuff now, but before I started this podcast, before I got into Goodreads and had these easy lists of books that I've read before. So this book is set in 2050, and for a 20-year-old book, came out in 1995, it holds up remarkably well, actually amazingly well, in terms of like the hard science fiction and the computing stuff, because it always talks about things at a slightly abstracted level, or not just a slightly abstracted level, sometimes many levels of abstraction. But culturally, things, you know, you can kind of draw a line from where we are now to there. You know, though, even though he, I guess Greg Egan was drawing a line from 1995 to 2050, we're still on the line that he drew, even though when he was writing, the internet was kind of a new thing. And oh, the internet, thankfully, the internet doesn't play a huge part in this. But there are some things which he's writing about, which seems to have come into being in a way which I found quite interesting to read. For example, at the start of the book, or at many points away through the first half of the book, they're talking about buying computer time. So people don't run programs on their own computers, they buy up computer times, which reminds me very much of like the Amazon Web Services and the SC3 or whatever those things are, where you just go, oh, okay, I need to do lots of computing, I need lots of storage and stuff, and I could do that myself, I could set up my own servers, I could do that, or I could just pay Amazon the amount of the money that I need. And, you know, Microsoft has, I think it's Microsoft Azure, and their kind of cloud computing. Really, it was talking more about like buying up cloud computing time before there was kind of an idea of it. You know, people go, oh, well, I'm on this, and we just need to get into the mainframe, or I don't even know what the different terminology would be, but it's stuff that you kind of see in the computing world today. And there's that's set up. I don't think there's much more need to say about that, but again, when we get into this, starting to actually talk about what this book is about. It's about computer simulations of human consciousness to provide an afterlife. And you have these people, these rich people, who set up a trust, who scan their brains, and once they've scanned their brains, they set up a trust. And when they die, their trust is instructed to, even though their simulations don't actually have any human rights. That's what's talked about. Oh, should they have human rights? Should they not have human rights? That's a question that the courts are looking at, and the UN is looking at, if the Charter of Human Rights should go to simulations. But even if they don't have human rights and laws don't apply to them, the trusts that they set up are bound to follow their instructions, and the trusts continue hopefully making enough money to pay for their computing time throughout their afterlife. And the idea is that they have to hang around and hang around and hang around until computing inevitably speeds up. And once computing, you can run your simulation not at 17 times slower, not at half the speed as normal humans, but one day computing time will speed up enough that you can run your simulation at 1-to-1 speed, and then you can put your brain into a robot. Oh, anyway, this is the kind of thing that that these simulations are hoping for at some point in the future. It's kind of like an insurance for the afterlife. And one of the main characters, Maria, is wanting this for, I think her mother is dying or maybe going to be dying soon. And she's like, just get yourself a scan, and we'll just get your scan, and we'll put it on file, and we'll get it running. And in the future, we'll all be able to get together, because I'm going to do this, and we'll all live together in this heavenly afterlife. And while it is, you know, portrayed as something interesting, the technology, it's like, this is very early adopter things. You know, only rich people and enthusiasts can scrape enough money together to run their simulations after they die and to keep paying for it. And it's there's these two characters. Well, the one character, can't remember his name, Paul. No, Paul is another character. One of these characters, Mike, maybe, I don't know. He's thinking, oh, well, I need to, I've just recently died, but this is an old scan, and I died when I was older, and this is an old scan. I didn't think I was going to die that soon. And then he has to go through therapy, and he goes in different things like that. And it's quite interesting for him to explore the afterlife, and he goes into these clubs where everyone is running at, you know, because if you're running at 17 times, or 17 percent, no, what is it? If you're running 17 times slower as a normal, that's actually quite expensive. So a lot of people run it 50 times slower, or 100 times slower, 200 times slower. And so there's these clubs where all these afterlife people get together, and they all decide that, hey, it doesn't matter how much time is passing in the real world, we're just going to run at the same, we're voluntarily going to run at the same speed as the slowest person in the club, just so we can all kind of hang out together and listen to the same amount of music on the same time and not have people skipping and things. So that's some interesting afterlife stuff as well. What else do we have? Oh yeah, some other things that I really enjoy. There's this guy called Paul Durham, who is one of the main characters, and he he's doing experiments on himself. He's the one that we find right at the very beginning. Is sort of like, oh, I'm a simulation. I want to kill myself. Oh, shit, I can't kill myself. Okay, the plan is me in the real world and me here in the simulation are going to do experiments on himself. And these are some of the most memorable scenes from the first time I read this book, you know, 15 years ago, whenever it was when he's, you know, doing these experiments on himself. And he's like, okay, and I'm going to take a break. I'm going to compute my brain for a second and then pause for 10 seconds and then start again for 10 seconds and go again for another 10 seconds and then pause for 10 seconds and then go. And I'm going to count to 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, going to count to 10 at the same time. And and he doesn't just like put breaks in his brain. He kind of experiments in, you know, doing it backwards in time and forwards in time and breaking causality and then splitting his computation of his brain into lots of smaller parts. And there's this fun line where he's got his brain running on 1,500 different servers all the way around the world, and he's literally going, I'm counting to 10 and my brain is as big as the world. And there's this line where he goes, here I am, mind as big as a planet, and you have me counting to 10, which I think is a Marvin Paranoid Android reference there. So all of these experiments that he does, there's a few chapters like in the first half of the book where he's like, right now I'm experimenting with myself. It's some really interesting mind-bending stuff, because it's not just like what the experiment is, but it's what he's thinking as he's counting to 10. And you realize everything that he's doing counting to 10 is actually running with this experiment. So that's the first third of the book is kind of exploring these. Oh no, there's one other big thing that is explored in the first third of the book, or the first half of the book, the first section of the book, is there's this thing called the Autoverse, and one of the main characters, Maria, is exploring the Autoverse. And the Autoverse is kind of like a game of life, Conway's game of life kind of thing, where you get set up some rules, and then you go and start, and then see what happens, and you set up like an initial configuration, and then you say go. But the rules describe interactions between a stripped down periodic table. So there's only like 35 molecules or 35 atoms that can only make up so many different connections, and there's lots of rules have been taken out, you know, like there's no such thing as gravity and things like that. We're just gonna run this system. And the idea being that it's really difficult to set up a system, or it's so far it's been impossible to set up a system where you can have like cellular life running, which can also evolve, because I'm guessing it's because the quantum mechanics or something like that, it's always a deterministic system. I'm not entirely sure exactly all the reasons and the rules why, but there's some interesting sections about like why does natural selection not work in, you know, Conway's game of life? Is it just because it's purely purely deterministic? Maybe, don't know. Anyway, so this stuff is going on, and she's trying to make different atoms and different molecules and lots of different things like that. And that's some interesting mind-blowing stuff there too. So this is all happening at the start of the book, and it's an interesting setup. And you're like, well, what is Paul Durner actually doing? Why is he doing this experimenting? And he comes to his realization. And then he gets out, and then there's some kind of weird conspiracy stuff going on, which not that big thing, and, you know, but what happens is, like, what is Paul Durham actually doing in the real world after he has had his, after he's done these experiments on his brain? What's changed about him that now he's spending all this money and collecting money from other people, and there's a fraud investigation, things? I'm not describing it very well. I don't want to give too much away of actually what happens, but it turns out that Paul Durham is setting up a new afterlife for rich people. They all have to give him $1 million each and a scan of their brain. Not people, but already dead people. It's people who are either just about to die or have already got the scans. He's like, give me a lot of money from your trust and I'll create a new afterlife. Now, this afterlife is called, is like a Garden of Eden kind of thing called Permutation City. Oh, that's part of it. And the idea being is that he has realized that every time... Well, he's come to lots of different conclusions, and it's driven him a bit crazy, but he's decided that maybe he's not crazy, but if he is crazy, but he can't take the chance of it. The idea being that he's going to set up a system, like a seed of a system, and run this system for a few minutes, and then stop and save the data, and then in the future, once computing becomes like near infinite, the system will run again, and for the people inside, there'll have been no pause, there'll have been no break. So he's kind of setting up this little compute, like this self-contained operating system, which in itself is based on this six-dimensional Conway's Game of Life kind of thing. And it's sort of like, we're going to have these different motions, and then we have this kind of, and each person has three dimensions of memories. Anyway, This is Greg Egan doing the talking here. So it's these many, many layers deep of simulations running on simulations running on simulations. And in the simulation is another simulation beside it to give those people something to an otherness. They need some alien life within this system so they can, like, observe what people are, what this alien life is doing in the autoverse. And it's this big thing setting up. Maria... Paul and Maria, the two main characters. Paul Durham is setting this up. Maria is kind of helping him, but not really wanting to help him because she thinks he's mad. And it's like, but this won't work. The idea, this whole thing that you're saying, like the way that you think consciousness works and computing works, it doesn't make sense. And I'm thinking when I'm reading this, no, it doesn't make sense. The only way that this can make sense is if Paul Durham is mad, but if he is mad, it means that it doesn't make sense. And so this big quandary is like, is this actually reality or is it not reality? Is this whole thing going to work or is this not going to work? And that's where the book really shines for me, is all the way through this middle section. It's like the people working on this thing is like, but we don't know if this dust theory of computing or dust theory, like, we don't know if that's actually real or not, or if this will work or not. And once we actually start the seed and stop it, how will we know that it ever go on in the future? And there's some interesting questions there as well. Some other fun characters, like I say, there's these... some characters who kind of stow away into this system. I'm not giving too much away there. That's talked about quite early in the middle, quite early on and throughout the middle. And there's another character, this German merchant banker, who is, I would say he's the most interesting character. He's not the most interesting character, but outside of the computer world, actually what happens in the real life, most of the characters are kind of like not so much one-dimensional, but they only have one dimension, like they only have one thing that they're wanting to do. There's like quite a few like obsessed characters, like this character is obsessed about this and they are spending all their time and money and doing that, and this character is obsessed about this and they're spending all their time and money doing this, and this, but you know, and it's always like they're all living inside these virtual worlds, whereas this German merchant banker is one of the only ones who actually did something meaningful in life, and that's kind of interesting, sort of like when he goes into the afterlife, or does he bring it with him? If you can edit your personality, should you take things with you? Like, if there's a defining moment in your life, is editing it out, will that change you so much that you won't be you anymore? And again, it's one of those things, is immortality meaningless if you don't change? Because if you don't change... There is no point in continuing on, but if you do change, the you that goes on into the future isn't the same you. Anyway, that's a good quandary to look at here in the science fiction. So, however, this does bring on to let's talk a little bit about the narration. That it was narrated by Adam Epstein, who I just looked up on my phone before, and the narration is mostly okay. There is this way of talking, this kind of pace that he has, of talking, how he does this, and I will now do this, and then the next sentence ends like this, and then I will do, and you go, okay, well, that's fine, it's a nice pace, it's kind of easy to listen to when someone has, like, the same kind of thing that they say, like, the way that they do their voice every sentence is the same, but at least you understand what's going on with each sentence and each paragraph, it's very clear. However, Adam Epstein is very, very, very bad at accents. He's obviously got his American accent. He's really good at American accent. And then suddenly there's these Australians start talking, because Maria is an Australian. She comes from Sydney. She starts talking, and it's just awful. And it's like, I'm Australian, and I'm talking... I'm really bad at accents, so I can't even do a good Australian accent. But I know when not to try and do an accent. But I could probably pull off an okay-ish Australian accent, but it would be like a comedy Australian accent. But it's difficult to do an impression of someone doing a non-comedy accent badly of a country that you can't also do that. And then, so Australian, pretty bad. There's some English people starts talking, and that is awful as well. And then he starts doing this German accent, and there's a few German accents. And then a German woman, and the German woman's accent is just... I don't know, it's just out of this world. I've never heard anything like it before. It reminds me of the, I think it's a scene in Inglourious Bastards where they're saying, oh, I speak Italian. No, I speak Italian. Wasio, oh, I can speak Italian. And then Brad Pitt goes, buongiorno. But it's even worse than that. It's like every kind of example of the accent that this could be. And I would play you a clip from the audiobook. However, I am actually recording this podcast on my phone, and the only way I have it is on my phone, so I can't use my phone to record. Anyway, it's a bit tricky. So I was just wondering, like, how, when they were producing this audiobook, like, how did they ever get away with this? Like, wouldn't the editor be just, or the producer just be going, hey, Adam, you know the accent? That is just really awful. Tell you what, just don't do accents. Just, like, put on a different voice. But when you're doing it, like, we'll just say this is the German person. Like, the character is distinct enough. Each of these characters, you're never really confused about who is talking or who is in what scene. The writing is actually very clear. In some ways, a little bit too clear. Like sometimes I was thinking, oh, I could really do with a bit of variety, a bit of variety in the writing. But otherwise, the writing is, you know, pretty decent. And it's just the accent's just so awful. It's like, I just don't know who let this through the edit. However, it is an enjoyable book, like as an audiobook. So I'm now going to do the Audible ad. If you enjoyed book recommendations that I've given in the past, check this out. Go to Audible. trial.com/SFBRP. That is actually the right letters in the right order. SFBRP and audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and sign up for a free trial, and you can get this audiobook for free if you sign up for a free trial there. And if this book doesn't seem to appeal to you, you can check out like 200,000 other audiobooks that they have there as well. And in doing so, you can support the SFBRP and there you go, free audiobook. Just sign up, and if you sign up for the gold account or the general account, you get one audiobook every month. I actually have a platinum account, which means I get two audiobook credits every month, and it's a really fantastic service. So I do recommend Audible. And yes, I say thanks for checking that out and supporting the SFBRP. audibletrial.com/SFBRP, which brings me on to some of the thematic things that I find. I mean, of course, I've talked a lot about the themes here, but some of the thing that I find a bit too disappointing, that is, like, I remember reading this book before. Once I was into it, I was reading it before reading it, and I remember a lot of these thought experiments that they're going through, a lot of the scenes that they're going through, a lot of the computing stuff, a lot of the mind-bending stuff, a lot of the, literally, I'm talking about mind-bending, not my mind being bent, but like the minds inside the book literally being bent backwards and forwards and through time and spread around, and like all these different really great things. I was just like, well, how can I not remember how it ends? It turns out that the last, like, third or the last few hours of the audiobook, this last section, really not so great, because, mild spoilers, they go into Permutation City, and it's just not interesting. Like, when you just go, oh, we're going to set this up, and this is going to be infinitely expanding computer simulation, and everyone can get as much space as they want, because everyone, you know, they just have to keep... Like, if you just wait a little bit longer, anything that you want to do, it'll just wait, and there'll be computing power in the future, and it'll keep going, and the whole dust theory that they're talking about, which is, you know, so weird. I'm not always entirely sure what's going on with that kind of stuff. But, like, it would have been so great if there's some really good scenes with Paul Durham where he goes, right, I've done it, I've achieved this, maybe, I don't know, but in the future, maybe this will work. If you just stop reading there and don't read part three or part two or whatever it is, Permutation City, the last third of the book, it's actually better, I reckon, because you kind of get bogged down in the end. Like, they set it all off in motion, and then it just keeps going through, and the kind of story kind of collapses, and the simulation kind of, oh, I'm not really sure what's going on. And then... And it gets this point, like, this often happens when you just go, well, if there's infinite everything, anything can happen. And I never really enjoy my hard science fiction when it gets to the point where you're just like, well, in a many worlds hypothesis of quantum physics, and anything can happen, it just so happens that in this universe, this happens, you know, and that's kind of an explanation of whatever happens, and the people within the story are saying, oh, well, that is the explanation of what's happening, and that's why this is doing this way. And I'm just like, don't, just keep a few steps back, or at least keep Like, if that's there, keep it in the background. Don't have characters explain to us each other, like, oh, well, in the many worlds hypothesis, anything can happen, so we can do this. And also, another thing that this kind of gets into a bit, maybe, where, and this has happened a lot in hard science fiction, where it's kind of the observer effect, or however it is, like the, I don't even know the terminology, but they kind of like, okay, there's this system that's coming together and there are no more observers left. So the last entity that observes the final state of the universe, or maybe the beginning state of the universe, anyway, they can decide on how the probability, like the quantum probability wave form collapses and decides what is real. So whatever they want to hold up as the reality, or whatever their experience of reality, once everything like that is actually the story. And you go, well, okay, that's not satisfying. I mean, it was satisfying the first time I read that. I was like, wow, mind blown. Like Stephen Baxter or whoever, no, probably before that, I don't know, whoever read this for the first time, I was like, oh, okay, that's an interesting thing. But like, as an end of a story, like, oh, whoever decides on the most thing, the most whoever has the highest probability wave factor, they decide what. And you just go, right, but that's not satisfying. I mean, it's kind of satisfying on a way which you go, ooh, okay, well, that tickles my brain. But once you've done it a few times, once my brain's been tickled in that direction a few times, I'm just going, yeah, okay, doesn't do it for me. It always kind of reminds me about these, I know someone like Richard Dawkins who's going, oh, well, we don't need religion. I get, I get to like a spiritual level experience by looking up at the stars and thinking of infinite universe. And I'm like, yeah, okay, that happens once for me. That doesn't. Oh, I get, I can think about evolution and how amazing evolution is. And that's how it just makes me feel so great. And I'm like, yeah, great. But like, that doesn't. Like, if you're an evolutionary biologist or an astronomer, you could probably feel that, like, every single time. But, like, I need sort of, like, variety of experience to have peak-level experiences. Like, you kind of got to do one better. You kind of, like, actually... It either has to actually be real, or I can contain it in my brain in a way, or can't contain it in my brain in a way, which is new. I don't know. So, and that's what I want from fiction. If it's just like, yep, yeah, okay, it as a purely intellectual pursuit... That's not going to do it for me. There has to be a bit more to that. So anyway, all of that to say that some of the stuff at the end of this book, though, while there is some good stuff in the last third, it doesn't really hold together as a satisfying novel in the way that the first like two thirds of the book does. So yeah, this is that kind of brings it to the end here, I reckon. Good book, decent book. I'm going to give it 3 stars. Because 3.5, no, I'll give it 3 stars. It's certainly worth reading, but like you have to kind of be in the mood for it as well. So 3 stars, and check it out. Permutation City by Greg Egan. So coming up next on the SBFRP, I'm going to be doing, well, I'm probably going to be doing the Otherland series by Tad Williams once I get home with Juliana, because she read or listened to the audiobook of that, or audio play of that as well. So we're going to be talking about that. So I'm going to wait until I get home for that. Otherwise, I've got some other books. I'm doing some Jack Vance Dying Earth stuff, book one, which I've read before. I know I've read that one before, so I'm enjoying that. In fact, it turns out like the last like 5 or 6 books in a row on the SPRBF I've read before, so I will get to a book which I've not won. Desolation Road by, I can't remember who that's written by, and I don't want to go away from my audio recording thing on my iPad to look on my iPod to look it up. Oh, I should have used my iPad to record this, and then I could have played stuff with my iPhone. Anyway, so what else have I got to say? Yeah, you can check me out and follow me on goodreads.com. Check out, find me on there. I'm Luke Burridge on Goodreads. I'm sure you can find it. And check out the SFBRP listener group. That's the best way if you want to get me to read a book, is to go into the books I would like to see reviewed on the SFBRP listener group on Goodreads and say, hey, this book. And if other people also say, yes, that book, which is what happened with Permutation City, I will get onto it and read it. And that's also what happened with Jack Vance and some others as well. I pretty much went all the way back through that discussion and picked out the books that have been recommended a few times or once or twice that I have not actually read or not read and reviewed for this and wanted to get to. So that's what I'm doing at the moment with this book and with Desolation Road and the Dying Earth series. So that's the best way to get me to read a book. Don't just send me a book recommendation using the built-in Goodreads book recommendation thing with no comment, because if I get loads and loads of them, I generally just ignore them. You have to put a comment in there or email me, luke@juggler.net. I apply to every single email me, every single email that I get. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Boge on Twitter. And I think that's about it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.